All right, if folks will grab their chairs, we will be underway. The Health and Human Services Finance Committee will be beginning. We do not yet have a quorum, but we will be proceeding, and we'll call the meeting to order when a quorum presents. Today, we will be having testimony from the Minnesota Department of Health, and we will be moving through the governor's budget and finishing the health portion today, having time for questions, and hopefully today we will finish up just a little bit early. So with that, Commissioner Ellinger is here, and if you'd like to proceed, we can get things going.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for inviting us here today to go over our budget and what the governor is proposing. I'm Ed Ellinger, the Commissioner of Health, and I'm here with Dave Greeman, who's the budget director for the Minnesota Department of Health. In the audience also are several of my staff who I'm sure will be able to answer any questions if you find one that stumps the commissioner. So they are sort of my lifeline just in case that happens. And normally when I talk about our budget, I like to do it in the context of what is public health and why we should invest in public health. But I did that earlier to this committee, so I won't review all of those activities and all of that again. But just to sort of reiterate, why should we invest in public health? We should for a variety of reasons. It saves lives. Of the 30 years of life expectancy that's been increased over the last 100 years, 25 of those 30 years are really because of our public health achievements. It helps improve the quality of life within our state. As we look at the physical environment, the social environment, the health environment, it really improves, as public health is working, it really makes it life worthwhile living in this state. It also adds to the prosperity of our state. A healthy community is a vibrant community. We know that places where there is a good environment, a healthy environment, that's where businesses like to come, that's where people like to live. And certainly as a grandfather, in looking forward to the health of my grandchildren and eventually great-grandchildren, we're investing in the future. The health that we have today is because of many of the public health investments that were made 20 and 30 years ago. So we're really laying the groundwork for a healthy future in our state. So I think those are all good reasons why we should invest in public health.
And Commissioner Ellinger, we will briefly pause, officially call the meeting to order. And with the first item of business, Representative Zerwas moves the minutes for January 29th, 2015. Is there any additions, corrections to the minutes? Seeing no corrections to the minutes, all those in favor of adoption, so signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. The minutes are adopted. Commissioner Ellinger, please proceed with your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On this slide, you can see the base budget of the Minnesota Department of Health, and that the majority of the dollars, actually, when you include all of the sources of federal dollars, some of which are out in that special revenue column and in the MERC column, really about 60% of the Minnesota Department of Health budget, it comes from federal dollars. And most of these come in terms of through competitive grants, not through formula grants. So that we have to compete for many of those dollars. So we're very dependent upon the quality of the programs, the competitiveness of the programs that we have, and the funding from the federal government, the level of funding that's there. General fund makes up only 14% of our overall budget. And several of our programs are particularly reliant on federal dollars. The Office of Emergency Preparedness, for example, 98% of those dollars are from federal sources. And this is the group that responds to public health emergencies, such as the flood in Duluth or the tornado in Minneapolis. They provide a lot of training around the state. They also store a lot of supplies in case of emergencies. So we're very dependent on this, and this federal source has been actually declining. So when we look at preparing for disasters and emergencies, this is of concern. Community and Family Health, which administers the WIC program and early childhood home visiting and pre-pregnancy family planning, which you'll hear about later on, again, is 81% federally funded. And our infectious disease epidemiology and prevention and control, the group that really responds in preventing and investigating and controlling infectious disease outbreaks like we've recently experienced with Ebola and measles and current flu and fungal meningitis from a couple of years ago and swine flu, this is really 85% funded by federal sources. So the federal sources declining means that we have a lot of pressure on the existing and remaining staff to do the job that really needs to be done. So we're concerned about what's going on at the federal level. And as we talk, we really I always talk about a public health enterprise. We really do need federal, state, and local partnerships, because this is a lot of the issues we deal with are national issues, but they're also local issues and state issues. So we need to have that collaborative approach. If you look at how the general fund dollars are spent, 67% of our general fund dollars go out in grants. Most of that to the local public health grant. The rest of it, as you can see, is payroll and lease rent and other operating services. Since the majority of our general fund dollars go out into local public health through the public health grant, I thought it would be good to show you where the community health agencies are. Minnesota has one of the best local, state and local partnerships in terms of public health. Really one, I believe, one of the best local public health systems in the nation. And it is really built on a strong partnership between the Minnesota Department of Health and local public health agencies, tribal governments, and the federal government that works also sometimes directly with local boards. All of the counties are covered by the community health boards or in tribal health directors in Indian Country. The 1976 Community Health Services Act established a framework and reorganized public health in the state. Prior to that, we had hundreds of local public health units in various sizes and shapes and levels of funding. We really coordinated that in 1976 with the Community Health Services Act and established a framework for funding up to the 52 existing community health boards at this point in time, the city, county departments that cover the entire state. Approximately $21 million annually is distributed to the local public health grant, to the 48 community health boards and 11 tribal governments, and then these leverage a lot of resources at the local level. In addition, at the local level, we have lots of other partners that we deal with. You would say all politics is local, well, all public health is local, with partnerships with state and federal. We certainly work with the public health agencies and tribal governments, but policymakers at the local level. As I go around pitching horseshoes with county commissioners, they're some of my best friends now because I recognize the importance that they play in advancing public health at the local level, particularly when we take a health in all policies approach, meaning that there is health in all of the decisions, policy decisions that are made at the local level. So I see those the county commissioners as great partners in public health. But we also work with health plans and health care providers and businesses and community organizations and schools and faith communities throughout the state at the local level. That is the partnership that we really are striving for. Just a couple of examples of what's going on at the local level for your interest. In the northeast region of Minnesota, we have a Delivering Healthy Babies project. It's called Superior Babies, and it's really working with pregnant teens and women who are using alcohol or other drugs to make sure that those get addressed appropriately and improve the birth outcomes for and healthy growth for these high-risk pregnancies. In the northwest region of our state, we have a real strong evidence-based home visiting program, which has intensive evidence-based activities to reduce child abuse and involve the county welfare system where appropriate. It has helped to reduce emergency room visits and really advanced improvement of healthy development. In the central region, where we've seen a lot of refugee resettlement, the number of refugees resettling in Stearns County, for example, has gone up from 300 in 2013, nearly 500 in 2014, and local public health really works with community agencies in terms of assessment and resettlement and getting them linked into the health systems within those communities. And then finally, in the Twin Cities metro region, one that most people don't think about, in the fact that the health in jail settings is really important. We have a lot of people going in and out of jail and prison, and the health within the correctional sites are really important. So the Washington County Public Health and Environment Department is really working on jail health and dealing with some really complex public health issues that comes through that system. So those are just some examples of what we do at the local level that we really fund, that helps fund with our local public health grant. And I will be going through Several of the proposals that we have that the government has, the governor has put into our budget, and we'll be, and I will go through some of these, and Dave Greenman will go through several of those. But I'll start out with the local public health grants, since we talked about the power of that state and local partnership. The governor proposes, because of the benefit of our local public health system, the governor is proposing to increase the local public health grant by 10% for the health boards in greater Minnesota, with a similar increase of 10% for Minnesota tribal governments. This increase will help strengthen the community health boards and tribal governments in dealing with some of the critical problems that are evolving and emerging in the 21st century. They will help us to really coordinate the efforts that we're doing statewide with what's going on at the local level. This is really important because you as a legislature and certainly we as a health department have invested a lot of public health responsibility in those community health boards. And the local public health grant is the primary state investment in local public health responsibilities. But since 1976, when the Community Health Services Act was initiated, that public health grant has not kept up with inflation. Currently less than 7% of the local public health expenditures come from that local public health grant, compared to 22% in 1979. So we really see that this needs to be one of the places where we invest, and certainly one of my priorities is to strengthen local public health. Having worked in local public health for 15 years, I see how important it is for them to be successful if we are going to be successful as a state. We're focusing on
Commissioner Ellinger, excuse me, Representative Loeffler has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Commissioner, or maybe it's Mr. Greenman. I know we're in the midst of a continually evolving budget process with MMB and layout of documents, but when I'm looking, and I just want to make sure that I'm understanding it, when I'm looking under the page that you have on page 12 on this local public health grant, on 13 you have your result measures related to quality, and you have previous and current, and then you have dates that are 2012 to 2013. And so I don't know how to interpret that. Is the previous last biennium or the biennium before, is current the biennium that we're currently in, and there's no projection of the impact of these investments in the next biennium? Or how do I interpret these column headings that go throughout?
Commissioner Ellinger.
Mr. Chair, Representative Loeffler, Dave Greenman with the Health Department. What these are meant to do is to show you what the trend line looks like. And so what this shows is the previous being the 2012 and the current, 2012, 2013 being the previous, and then the current would be presumably 14 and 15. We can clarify that for you.
Mr. Chair and Mr. Greenman, I think it would really be useful just in general on the budgets, and I'd be glad to follow up with MMB, for us to get projections based on the investments that you've put forward here. And my question, particularly on the public health grant investments, is that you're indicating that 32% of the current community health boards are able to have fully implemented the identified priorities, and that their average percent of performance measures fully met are 51%. And if you could get us some data on how that correlates with the location of the county, what percent of in your proposal would be addressed by just targeting the funds to greater Minnesota, and are all the metro counties the superstars because of property tax investments or whatever? Where do the regional centers fall? It would just be useful to know how this correlates to the proposed investment.
Yep. Commissioner, please proceed.
Ms. Beard and Representative Left, thank you for bringing that up. Actually, it highlights a point that as the Minnesota Department of Health was one of the first state health departments to be accredited, and we are working with our local partners in local public health to also have them move towards accreditation. Certainly not a mandatory thing, but we really want them to work towards accreditation because it really improves the quality, and they can articulate then the importance of what they do and how they do it in their communities. And the reason that we are, and we will get you the information in terms of how the local health departments are meeting some of those criteria on a statewide basis. To highlight the fact that we really, why we're focusing this investment on rural communities, because of the investment and some of the issues that are in rural communities that could really benefit from this additional funding through the local public health grant. The next proposal for funding is evidence-based home visiting. That's on page 14 of your budget pages. This is part of the governor's focus on children and families, and it's to provide evidence-based home visiting to an additional 200 to 300 pregnant and parenting teens at risk for or an at-risk pregnant women or at-risk families. We know that adverse childhood experiences, the things that occur early on in life related to poverty, child abuse, substance abuse, mental illness, incarceration, really limit the potential of children to achieve healthy goals and reach their full potential. So that's why the earlier we can intervene with some of the preventive measures, some of the supportive measures, the bigger impact we will have. Certainly, I argue that one of the greatest things you can do for third grade reading is to reduce some of those adverse childhood experiences in the first year of life. That's why those evidence-based home visiting programs are designed to intervene at the earliest time possible to assist families and help them with needed health and social services that they would qualify for. It is evidence-based. It has been shown to prevent child abuse and neglect. It has been shown to encourage positive parenting, promote child development and school readiness, and it helps to improve economic stability among families. The data show that for every dollar that we invest in evidence-based home visiting, we can expect about $5.70 return on that kind of investment. Many of those returns are in the public programs like Medicaid and food support and TANF. This is important because I think it really is, it fits with what our goals are for the state and certainly what the governor is trying to accomplish with the focus on childhood and its importance to the long-term prosperity of our state. These funds would be awarded to community health boards and tribal nations and complement the existing home visiting services that we are already supported by state and federal funds. Every community health board or tribal nation that is implementing evidence-based programs would be eligible to apply for these.
Excuse me, Commissioner Representative Mack.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Commissioner Ellinger, would you just be able to speak to whether or not the nurse family partnership is included in something like this? I know that's a nonprofit that partners with the department. Would they be included in this allocation?
Commissioner Ellinger.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mack, Nurse Family Partnership, it does provide one of those evidence-based home visiting programs, so it would be eligible for that.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any other questions on this? Otherwise, we'll move on to the Family Planning Special Projects on page 16. The governor is proposing adding $2 million to the Family Planning Special Projects funding that is used to promote and increase the number of pregnancies that are healthy, by supporting statewide access to culturally appropriate family planning, counseling, education, preconception care, screening for sexually transmitted infections, and the related laboratory testing that goes along with it. It has been shown that evidence-based family planning services are really beneficial in improving the health of infants and families and certainly children. By getting it before someone becomes pregnant to deal with substance abuse, diet, tobacco use, physical activity, a whole variety of issues, you can really increase the healthiness of that pregnancy. We know that about half of the pregnancies in this country and in Minnesota are unintended pregnancies, and we know that a planned pregnancy is really one that is healthier and has better outcomes in a whole variety of ways. It lowers infant mortality rate, it lowers maternal mortality, it decreases costs in medical care, and it improves child development. It's shown that an investment of a dollar in preconception family planning saves about $3.75. This proposal really is important because it addresses not only the family planning issues, but we'll really, through the family planning special project, really focus on some of the disparities that we have in infant mortality rates and sexually transmitted infections, which are increasing in the sexually transmitted infections in many areas are increasing in the state, which is one of the concerns that I certainly have as a pediatrician, seeing how that impacts pregnancies. So family planning special projects will help to address some of those areas. This will be distributed on a population-based formula to throughout the state.
Commissioner, there's a question. Representative Franson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, I've got a couple of questions for you. Could you give us a breakdown of the FTEs with the family planning special projects compared to positive alternatives?
Commissioner Ellinger.
Mr. Chair, Representative Franzen, I will see if Dave Gold agreement might be able to answer that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Franzen, I don't have that with me right now, but we can certainly get that for you.
Okay, that would be great. And then follow up.
Representative Franzen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Commissioner, I'm also wondering if you could provide the committee with the breakdown of exactly how those family planning special grants are broken down to who gets how much, what, whereabouts in the state. That would be helpful as well. You probably don't have that information handy, but you could provide that to the committee. That would be great.
Commissioner Ellinger.
Mr. Chair, Representative Franz, yes, we can certainly get that information. Family planning special projects grants go to local community health boards, various community agencies throughout the state, and so we can get that breakdown for you so you'll see where they are.
Thank you.
Commissioner, I noticed that there in each of the districts there's a Planned Parenthood within each one. Do you know approximately what percentage of the overall budget is through Planned Parenthood?
Mr. Chair, I'm hoping that a budget director might have that information.
I have the, Mr. Chair, I have the amounts with me. It would probably take a minute or two to calculate what percentage is Planned Parenthood versus the other grantees.
That'd be fine, whenever. But thank you, and Commissioner, please continue.
And in our in your budget book, we do have our Ebola deficiency request and the hospital request. I know we've gone over that with you in the past. I'm not sure if you would like us to review that again or if you heard enough about our Ebola deficiency request.
Commissioner, I think we have covered that in committee. I think most of the committee members were present for that, and we have we will be seeing that again, I understand, in Ways and Means. But if committee members have questions about that, this would be a good time for questions about either the budget, deficiency budget, or about the process itself for the hospital stepping forward. This would be an appropriate time. Seeing none, Commissioner, please proceed.
Mr. Chair, at this point, I will turn it over to Dave Greenman to go through some of the other budget pages that we have.
Thank you. Mr. Grimman.
Mr. Chair, the next budget proposal is on page 22, and in this proposal, the governor recommends $900,000 from the general fund and $283,000 from the Health Care Access Fund for compensation increases in fiscal years 2016 and 2017. This represents an annual increase of 1.8%. Over the past several years, compensation costs have increased due to labor contracts, fringe benefit increases, and also other payroll contributions. Over the past 10 years, the average increase in compensation costs per FTE has been 1.8%. This proposal is important because absorbing these costs within our existing base budget results in reduced staffing or reduced non-staffing resources, which reduces our ability to reduces the quality and the amount of services we're able to provide. The governor's proposal is recommended to allow us to continue to maintain our current level of operations and services. There are no new FTEs in this proposal, although the amount of the increase represents approximately the cost of 4.2 FTEs in fiscal year 16 and 8.4 in fiscal year 17.
Mr. Grimman, could you just state what the uses for the Health Care Access Fund are and if those are new or if they are ongoing or if they're a change?
Mr. Chair, I'm not clear. Are you talking about the amounts in this current budget proposal?
Yeah, you had referenced it, and it's on the top of page 22 in the budget book. Just historically, have we done that? Is that a new use for healthcare access dollars? I'm just not aware of that. And if so, is it the same or new or what is it?
Mr. Chair, we fund a number of FTEs at the department out of the healthcare access fund, and so and that's a direct appropriated fund from the legislature. And what this would represent is 1.8% of those FTE costs, an increase which is similar to what we're doing with the general fund, looking at what our compensation costs are and adding 1.8% to that. So these are existing FTEs. We haven't in the past received an operating increase for a number of years, so we haven't done this in a number of years, but this is what the governor's proposing this time around.
Thank you.
The next proposal on page 23, the governor is recommending an investment in strengthening protections for vulnerable adults in settings where supplemental nursing service agencies are used. Supplemental nursing agencies provide temporary staffing for nursing homes, hospitals, home care providers, and other healthcare settings that serve vulnerable adults. The use of the temporary staffing has increased over the past 5 years. The department currently registers 73 supplemental nursing agencies in the state. However, the registration requirements and the resources to enforce those requirements are minimal and are insufficient to properly protect vulnerable adults. As one example, recently the department initiated a revocation action against a nurse staffing agency that sent an employee with an assault record to a nursing home and where that person allegedly committed sexual abuse against a vulnerable adult. The agency had failed to provide a background check on that person before hiring them. And although that's rare, this kind of situation demonstrates the importance of enforcing standards for nursing agencies. What this proposal would do is provide resources to enable the department to inspect these agencies once per year, which is what we do with nursing homes. It covers legal fees and staff time so that we can increase inspections or investigation complaints and enforcement actions, and requires supplemental nursing agencies to provide us with records as we request them. This proposal protects vulnerable adults in healthcare settings by ensuring that the temporary staff are subject to the same requirements and standards as permanent staff. The proposal increases fees by approximately $147,000 and adds one FTE to this program starting in fiscal year 16. The last time that fees for this type of activity was increased was in 2002. Okay. The next proposal is on page 25. Governor recommends a series of measures to improve oversight of the mortuary science industry. Our mortuary science program at the department currently regulates over 600 facilities and 1,200 professionals working in the mortuary science field. Current funding is not sufficient to oversee this large and rapidly changing industry. There is a significant backlog in inspections with our program, only 19 of 59 crematories, and less than half of the funeral homes in the state have been inspected in the last 2 years as required by statute. There's also been we've also seen an increase in consumer complaints. The department currently receives about one complaint a week for issues like misidentification and viewing of the wrong body, deceased person, I should say, preneed trust funds not being available in the at the time that they're needed, cremating without proper authorization, and other types of conduct.
Mr. Greenman, we have a question from Representative Lane.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was just curious about what that might be, that misidentification and viewing of the wrong decedent. That kind of perks one's attention, and could you give more clarification on that?
Mr. Greenman.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lane, I believe that would be a situation where when there's a sort of a viewing, I assume at a funeral home, where the wrong deceased person is put out for the viewing.
Representative Lane.
I was just wondering if that was the actual case or if it was something perhaps lesser that somebody was identifying a body or something. But that is pretty interesting as far as the inspection and licensure of our homes and our funeral directors, that they are operating in a proper manner so that they don't make such mistakes. I just want to also call members' attention to a paragraph above that. It talks about changes in the in the field, a push for more green funerals and burials, and I'm a part of a group that actually pushes in that area. So I'll just call your attention that green burials are actually becoming an exponentially greater interest across the nation. We have more in the local area than before, and it's just booming. I think that as the baby boom ages and as their parents start to die and we start to look at how we're going to do this, the interest in a green burial becomes just very, 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 very high interest. And also the opportunities for family members to be more involved in the final disposition of their loved ones. I just remind people that two, three generations ago, we did this. A friend of mine remembers in Northeast Minneapolis, Grandma was in the home with the church ladies came over to help, and Grandpa was in the home, and the church guys came over and helped. This was very, very normal. This funeral industry is relatively new, and we've given over the care of a deceased to them. And there's a strong group across the nation that wants to remind us that this is really a part of our natural life cycle, and that we need to be more involved ourselves, and a lot of people are taking more interest in this. And I know the Mortuary Science Department has been working with me on this and reminding funeral directors that they don't own the area, that the family actually has the control of the body. Thank you.
One more question from Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Commissioner, I'm wondering if these, you know, it seems like an area where you pointed out some serious issues, but it sounds like you're handling it as a complaints-driven and an inspection sort of a process. But is there an ombudsperson role either in your agency or in Commerce to deal with an issue like, for example, pre-need trust funds not available at the time of need? I mean, that seems like something that we should have someone in state government who should be able to help the consumer sort it out fairly quickly, as opposed to waiting till the next inspection or waiting a month later to deal with a complaint. And I don't know, I'm not sure if that's in your responsibility or the Department of Commerce.
Commissioner Ellinger?
Madam Chair, Representative Loeffler. We do proactively work with, and the issue that you're raising also with Representative Blaine, the funeral industry is changing dramatically. So we actually proactively do a lot of education to meet the changing needs of the funeral industry and really work with all of the programs on their pre-trust groups. We certainly work with the Department of Commerce on those issues in collaboration with what they're doing. So we do a regulatory basis, and we also do a proactive education training procedures in our mortuary science program.
Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And Commissioner, the question I had more was, like, if I had a family member who had a pre-burial trust, and the nursing, the funeral home that is closest chooses not to honor that, or the trust is unwilling to release the funds, is there someone who can assist the family at that point in just working out what is the legal responsibility, or is that really up to the consumer?
Commissioner Ellinger.
Madam Chair, Representative Loeffler, when this has occurred in the past, we have worked with the Attorney General's office to make sure that the individual family's needs are met. So this is a collaborative sort of effort through consumer protection.
Thank you. I'm glad someone is there.
Mr. Greer.
Madam Chair and Representative Loeffler, one other thing I would add regarding the funeral trust is our role at this point is to require the funeral home to submit data on their pre-need trusts. However, we don't have the staff with the expertise to actually look at the data and make an evaluation of whether the trusts are being kept as they should be for the funeral needs. And so one of the things we're doing with this proposal is we could either hire somebody with that kind of expertise to review the trusts, or we could require the nursing home, the funeral home, to submit their information for an audit, an independent audit of their pre-need trusts, and provide that to us as sort of documentation that the trusts are being appropriately managed. And what we've chosen to do is put in the requirement for the independent audit.
Thank you. All right, and just briefly, members, to interrupt, I just want to point out MDH just handed out some information regarding Representative Franson's question on the family planning special project. So that's just what came around. Mr. Greenman.
Madam Chair, so just to finish with this proposal, we currently only have 1.35 FTEs working on this regulatory program, and as a result, resolving a complaint can take up to 6 months, which we determine is just too long for families in need. So what this proposal would do is enable the department to inspect nursing or funeral homes every 2 years, enhance training and education requirements for practitioners, protect consumers from deceptive pricing and financial practices, and update safety requirements. Fees on the industry would be increased to cover an appropriation of $187,000 per year starting in fiscal year 16, and the proposal will add 1.65 FTEs to this program. The fees for this program were last increased in 2007.
Okay. Carry on.
Mr. Chair, the next proposal is on page 28. The governor recommends implementing a new dementia training requirement that for housing with services providers that was passed into law in 2014. The legislation requires employees of housing with services providers who advertise Alzheimer's care to receive training on working with persons with dementia. The law goes into effect January 1 of 2016, the training requirements go into effect January 1 of 2016, but before they go into effect, the 2014 law that established the requirements directed the department to work with stakeholders to develop a report on how to implement and enforce the new training requirements for housing with services providers, and this legislation actually represents the results of that work. The new requirement for training applies to direct care workers, housing managers, and non-direct care staff such as maintenance workers and food service workers. Under this proposal, what we're planning to do is, rather than immediately enforcing the new training requirements and penalties for non-compliance, we're going to work with the housing with services providers for 1 year to provide technical assistance on how to transition into meeting the new requirements and provide and conduct compliance reviews to ensure that they're meeting those requirements. And these changes are necessary to implement and enforce requirements that are already in place to protect this extremely vulnerable population. The fiscal impact of this proposal would be $11,000 from the state government special revenue fund in fiscal year 17 and $22,000 per year thereafter, and that additional appropriation is covered out of existing fees to the program.
Does anyone have any questions?
The next proposal, the governor recommends updating the Health Information Exchange Oversight Program to address changes and growth in this market and to better align with federal standards and provide clarity to the Health Information Exchange providers and the healthcare providers who use their services. Under Minnesota law, all providers are required to have an electronic health records system in place that can exchange records with other health records systems to securely exchange health data. Many providers in the state are already exceeding those requirements. Approximately 40% of the clinics and hospitals in the state are able to securely exchange data with unaffiliated providers, which is beyond what's currently required, and we expect that percentage to continue to grow over the years. Minnesota's Health Information Exchange Law was passed in 2010 to ensure that there's a reliable health information exchange infrastructure in place to support secure exchange of data, protect patient privacy, ensure adherence to state and federal law, and to create transparency in the market. The law requires the department to certify health information exchange providers. These providers are the entities that govern and facilitate the secure exchange of data and also provide infrastructure to connect computer systems for the secure transmission of health information. Minnesota's law governing health information exchange was passed when the industry was still in its infancy, and since then it needs to be updated basically because there's a number of new methods to exchange health data that were not contemplated when the law was first passed. what the law does is clarify, what the proposal does is clarify what methods should be covered by Minnesota's law and simplify the certification process. What it does is ensures that whenever data from health information exchange happens between providers, privacy of patients is protected. We follow state and national standards. It also would allow health information exchange providers who meet federal certification requirements to be certified by the state. And it streamlines the application and fee structure and actually reduces fees for certain types of providers. We expect the number of providers in the state to triple over the next few years so that even though fees are lowered for some providers, the actual fee revenue coming in would increase about $100,000. We would use that additional revenue to continue operating the program with a higher level of certified providers.
Continue, Mr. Greenman.
The next proposal is on page 32. The governor recommends measures to protect Minnesotans from harmful effects of lead and radon by establishing Minnesota-based programs for lead and radon abatement. Lead-based paints were banned in 1978. However, there are still about 550,000 homes in Minnesota that have that still contain lead hazards from paint. Renovating or repairing these homes can expose children and their families to toxic levels of lead, which could cause learning disabilities, behavioral problems, and at very high levels, possibly seizures or even death. Currently, the Federal Environmental Protection Agency regulates these lead renovation contractors who remove lead from Minnesota homes. However, due to limited resources, the EPA cannot provide adequate enforcement of this law to ensure contractors are protecting the public from lead exposure. The EPA recommends that oversight be moved to the state level to ensure that to improve the effectiveness of the program. What this proposal would do is shift responsibility for regulating lead contractors who remove lead to the Department of Health. A Minnesota-based program would provide for more local control and use of Minnesota-specific strategies to address possible lead hazards. The Minnesota program, which we're proposing, would be supported by a certification fee of $100 charged every 2 years on the contractors who do lead abatement work, which is lower than the current federal fee of $300 every 5 years. This portion of the proposal would appropriate approximately $386,000 from the state government special revenue fund in fiscal years 16 and 17 and add 2.5 FTEs when the program is fully implemented. The governor also recommends establishing state licensure requirements for the radon mitigation industry to ensure that work is of high quality and effectively reduces the risk of lung cancer by minimizing radon exposures. Radon is the number one leading cause of lung cancer in non-smokers. In Minnesota, 2 in 5 homes have radon levels that pose a health risk, and nearly 80% of the counties in Minnesota are rated high radon zones. The greatest risk for radon exposure is indoors where radon is allowed to collect. The Minnesota Radon Awareness Act.
Sorry, Mr. Greenman, Representative Liebling has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Greenman, maybe you weren't quite done with the radon piece, but I had a related question, and that is last year I kind of leaned on your department a bit to work on mold. And it's, of course, related. And I've just wondered if now might be a good moment if you can just, I'm glad to see that we as a state have moved forward on radon. And, of course, Representative Norton carried the bill to include radon abatement in new housing and kind of brought this issue to the fore. But we do have kind of a statewide problem with mold, that we don't have standards for mold in housing. And I wonder if you could give me a brief update on that. Maybe if this isn't the time, you could just take the question under advisement maybe and come back with that, but just to know that I'd like to have an update since we're talking about these kinds of housing hazards right now.
Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, I'd be happy to sit down with you with the staff who are knowledgeable about this and maybe talk a little bit more with you about where we're at with that
activity.
Okay,
thank you.
Mr. Chair, as Representative Liebling just mentioned, the Minnesota Radon Awareness Act was passed in 2013, and what that's done is greatly increased the number of homes that are tested for radon. Currently, there's been about 3,000 homes that have had radon mitigation work done in 2014. However, it takes highly skilled contractors to evaluate and install radon reduction systems without damaging the homes or putting residents in jeopardy. The Health Department has received a number of complaints from contractors and from residents about radon work that has potentially resulted in some dangerous conditions. Some of those conditions include exposure to high levels of carbon monoxide due to lack of airflow, leaks or floods due to failure to reconnect sump systems, increased risk of fire due to not using fire-rated materials or completing improper electrical work, and most frequently just charging families for thousands of dollars for work contracted work that did not have the effect of reducing radon levels in the home. What this proposal does is establish the licensing program for radon and a fee structure that mirrors those used in at least 10 other states. The annual cost of the proposal is $350,000 per year and adds 2.5 FTEs. The next proposal is on page 35. The governor proposes to align the licensing and regulatory activities for retail food establishments between the Minnesota Departments of Health and Agriculture. The two departments have shared responsibility for licensing retail food establishments. However, a recent comparison between the programs between the two departments revealed a number of large differences in licensing and fee structures, in training requirements, and for inspection staff, and also in how inspections are conducted. We have different methods for obtaining compliance and different methods for methods and authorities for enforcing the requirements. What this proposal would do is create the first step toward aligning and streamlining the programs between the two agencies. It would establish a unified licensing structure that sets fees based on an establishment's level of risk, which would be based on the frequency and the length of inspections rather than on the size of the establishment. The unified fee structure doesn't raise fees for any category of licensure, but the new method of setting fees does generate an additional $500,000 in revenue for the state government special revenue fund. What we're proposing to do is invest those funds in further aligning the two agencies' programs to result in more clear and consistent requirements for business owners, more consistent application of the retail food standards, and more effective communication between the departments. We anticipate the results of this will be reduction in foodborne illness in the state. What we propose to do is to continue to work with stakeholders to align, to analyze the differences between the retail food activities of the Agriculture Department and the Health Department, to look at the differences and bring them into alignment, and we propose to introduce legislation in 2016 and 2017 to implement those policy recommendations. And a companion proposal has been brought forward by the Health Department, or excuse me, by the Agriculture Department. And the last proposal I was planning to talk about today was the Drinking Water Protection Program. It's on page 38. The governor recommends increasing the state government special revenue fund appropriation by $2.4 million per year to maintain and expand the existing water protection activities. This proposal would also free up federal resources for to help local water suppliers meet their infrastructure needs. The increased appropriation is paid for through an increase in the public water service connection fee from $6.36 to $8.28 per year. The increased funding will support the department's drinking water protection program, which monitors public drinking water suppliers to assure the public their drinking water is safe. The program samples public water supplies, certifies drinking water operators, enforces the Safe Drinking Water Act, and provides technical assistance to water operators. Over time, the cost of the drinking water protection program has increased, and additional funds are needed to maintain current services at their current levels. In addition to maintaining the program, we'll be providing continued support 24-hour emergency response to any drinking water emergencies that occur in the state. We will be increasing, what this proposal does is increase the amount of funding from the federal drinking water revolving fund that's available to local water suppliers to improve their infrastructure and maintenance, and also assumes greater responsibility from the Environmental Protection Agency for testing contaminants in drinking water. The drinking water service connection fee was last increased in 2005, and it's typically increased once every 10 years.
Thank you, Mr. Greenman. Representative Purcell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just curious if the drinking water funds that you're using and any of the new funds that are being proposed, are they for helping to keep drinking water supplies from getting contaminated, or is it all just where we test it and if it's okay for nitrates or metals, whatever, it's okay? But are we doing anything to keep water clean, I guess, is my question.
Mr. Green.
Mr. Chair, Representative Purcell, we currently do we do a lot of testing of the drinking water supply systems in the state to ensure that there's not contaminants in there and to identify if there are contaminants to get them removed. We also look for we have some Minnesota specific health based limits on contaminants in our drinking water. We test those as well to determine whether there's Minnesota specific contaminants in our drinking water.
Representative Purcell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess where I'm going with this is that right up I'm part of Hubbard County, and my district in Park Rapids has a significant nitrate issue down there, and they now know that that's related to potato farming, and the nitrogen that's used in growing the potatoes and went right straight down through the sand. And are you familiar with the Park Rapids issue? And my concern is, I mean, it's costing Park Rapids taxpayers lots of money, and they didn't create the problem. And so my concern is that do we have something in place to work with MPCA, Ag Department, somehow that you all in state government are working to keep this from happening again?
Mr. Chair, Representative Purcell, I neglected to mention that we have a package of proposals to for projects in the Clean Water Fund that aren't before this committee, and that would include a number of activities related to source water protection to protect source water from having the contaminants flow into it. We also have one way in which contaminants get into drinking water is through unsealed wells. We're proposing to spend a significant amount of money to assist private landowners to seal their wells. And so we are actually doing a number of things to protect the contaminants from getting into the drinking water.
Representative Purcell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just to follow up on that, it sounded to me like you've got some grant money that you're talking about, Clean Water Fund that you're talking about. Sounds like, do you have any general fund money that you spend on prevention?
Mr. Greenman.
Mr. Chair, I think I would ask somebody from the environmental health area to comment quickly.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Tom Hogan. I'm the Division Director for Environmental Health with the Health Department. And to maybe get at the question that the representative asked, there is funding that is provided through the federal government for that type of activity. There's not really general fund money that's appropriated for that type of activity to the state agency within the Health Department. Most of our activity in Clean Water Act or Safe Drinking Water Act activity is fee generated or through federal government funding.
I think I'm getting to where I want to be with my questions and answers, Mr. Chair. Does the Safe Drinking Water Act money, the federal money, do you have some of that you use for prevention?
Some of that funding is for source water protection planning activity with the community water systems. So working with community systems to seek protections for infiltration areas for groundwater.
And Mr. Chair, and thank you, and teaching them about the Park Rapids experience. I'm bringing this up because it's a it's a pretty big deal for taxpayers up my way.
Right, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the Health Department is certainly involved in that activity in the Park Rapids area and working with the community system there to seek solutions for how to reduce that groundwater contamination.
Representative Purcell.
Thank you. And my point is that you're teaching other people around the state how not to do what happened to Park Rapids. Is that happening?
Mr. Hogan.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, yes, we are.
Thank
we
you.
Are working to do that as well.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Purcell. And just one other question that I had about the fee increases for the water. How would a taxpayer see that? Would that be on a water, the connection increase, would that be on a water bill? Would that be on a permit request? Where would the a homeowner see that? And then secondarily, are there other increases or changes in either policy or fiscal changes that would apply to either a permit holder or somebody that's trying to get a water permit, changing their usage, or somebody just paying their water bill?
Mr. Chair, I believe you would see the fee increase on your water bill whenever that comes in. I'm not sure if it's, I don't recall whether I get my bills quarterly or annually or not, but that's when you would see the fee increase. And I think I'd probably have to ask somebody else to come up and talk about whether there's any permit changes. No, excuse me, I'm getting the answer no, there's not any. In reference to the second part of your question, there are no changes in how people would go about and get their permits and fee increase or the cost that, of getting those. Is that, I'm not sure if that answers your question or not.
That does. Thank you.
Okay.
Other questions? Or are you finished with the sections, I believe, that pertain to this committee? I think you're either at or very near the end. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that's the last proposal that's before this committee. We also, there's one proposal for the Toxic Free Kids Act, which is in front of the Environment Committee, and then there's a number of Clean Water Fund proposals as well.
Thank you. Other questions for the Commissioner and Mr. Greenman on the health portions of the budget from the governor? Other questions? All right. We do have coming up, we have a joint, is that tomorrow? The joint hearing, and we will be answering, hearing public testimony on next week. And if folks want to, that will likely have a lot of people that want to testify on behalf of that. If advocates are here or others, if they could get to Mr. Stolarczyk, the committee legislative assistant for the hearing. Also, we have limited access to the ground, so if people need extra help getting around, want to make sure that we allow extra time, and also to let us know if folks need extra assistance in accessing the building or the room. Certainly we'll be as accommodating as possible in doing that. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this question is for you. I wonder if you could give the committee, or certainly the minority, a bit of a roadmap about how you intend to proceed through the rest of our committee time here in terms of putting together the budget bill. So far we haven't seen any, I realize there are some budget, HHS budget impact bills kind of making their way through, and I assume we'll be hearing some of those, but I'm just thinking in terms of the process of assembling the omnibus bill. whether you'll be hearing bills and then laying them over and coming out with a bill, as I've seen done in the past, or could you just give us a bit of a roadmap on that?
Certainly, Representative Liebling, we'll be working very closely with Chair Mack, and several of the bills are going to be beginning there and will be taking shape and moving into our committee. Looking forward to the budget forecast. The governor's budget is the first piece, the forecast second. We are going to be assembling those bills and keeping an eye to the committee deadlines, and would certainly encourage members on the committee, majority and minority, to get anything that costs money to committee administrator and as soon as possible.
Okay, thank you.
Anything else? With that, we are adjourned. Thank you.